Okay, well, I wind up today by discussing some of the work I've been doing with Sirat Matiska on looking at the dynamical influences of the post-perovskite phase transition, and especially for lower mantle plumes. And this post-perovskite transition lies very close to the CMB. So you have a strong influence on the boundary layer dynamics, and we cannot use a lot of the conventional ideas that you've learned from your classroom exercises and borrowing fluid dynamics books. It's rather unfortunate that this phase transition lies very close, unlike Venus, which may lie above, because we're no longer, we could use a lot of the theories, okay, because you have this phase transition produces strong nonlinear interaction. In some places, you may not even have a phase transition due to the undulations in the temperature. And I'd like to point out here the effect of viscosity and then thermal conductivity, because this is also a constraint on the nature of the super plume. Because when you put this new phase transition in there, we find that the super plume disappears, so we need to bring it back again. Okay. So the fact of the matter is,
you had made it original.
No problem. This, you know, we made it a thermal conductivity. Yeah. I mean, this is a. Okay, so this is a hierarchical, a multi-scale problem, especially now you have this phase transition right here. And the various aspects of this problem is quite rich, okay, ranging from the really small-scale flow you have in compaction to large-scale circulation. And it's this super plume that we'll focus our attention on. The model we've looked at is relatively simple now, because we need high resolution. Because now you have a phase change right near the boundary layer, so it's a double whammy. Okay, so to do this problem in 3D now would be very foolhardy, unless you're going to use an Earth simulator with many points. Okay, so you need resolutions at least 4 to 20 kilometers ranging. Okay, so to do this with a regular finite element code like Terra or Sitcom would be impossible in today, unless you go over to Tokyo. Okay. So now we're focused on two phase transitions, the Spinel and perovskite, and perovskite to post-perovskite, but we also look at the influence of the sine of Clapeyron slope, since we're motivated by the work of Dan Shim, who found that there could be a negative Clapeyron slope, and you have the negative Clapeyron slope, then you still have super plume. So this question of whether or not super plume exists also depends on what we get out from the sine of a Clapeyron slope. Okay, so we must determine the sine from various sources. And I guess right now, the consensus is that the positive Clapeyron slope prevails over the negative Clapeyron slope. So this model has a depth-dependent and temperature-dependent viscosity. We also put in the depth-dependent thermal expansivity, and we're going to test out two different models here with the constant thermal conductivity and radiative thermal conductivity. We have not used lattice thermal conductivity, because the lattice thermal conductivity is important only in the upper mantle, especially for slabs, so tend to heat up the slabs. And we want to make the model as a simple as possible in order to understand the physics. Okay, so I'm going to show why when you put in more physics, you put more constraint in your problem. And recent work by Bajro also indicates the importance of radiative heat transfer. So now we have this setup here, where the SPP means the Spinel to perovskite transition, the PPP is the post-perovskite phase transition, and this B double prime layer. And we have also looked at the influence of this depth, okay, and this is an important parameter. You move it too close, then your solution starts to be act in a weird manner. Okay, so right now we only put the transition at about 150 kilometers. And so this is a mean transition. And let me show you first the influence of depth-dependent viscosity without putting temperature-dependent in. And this is the depth-dependent we've chosen. It's from Forte and Mitrovica. And this is the one without the phase transition. So this is your normal model with P is the parameter indicating the phase transition. Okay, so here is zero. This is the post-perovskite phase transition. K equals to one means it's constant thermal conductivity. And you can see here that we get this focusing effect. Okay, that's well known from the work I did with Uli Hansen, that the effect of depth-dependent property is to focus. Okay, it's like it's difficult to have convection, and when you have it, you like to focus. What? No, this is 3,000 kilometers, okay. Two and a half orders of magnitude in depth, okay. This is the model of, well, this is the Hill model, okay. Yeah, well, double hump, we don't want to get the... Okay, so now we look at what happens when we put in the phase transition. Okay, so this phase transition is has a slope which is not so high, it's about 5 megapascals, is positive. And you see here that you could get the secondary instabilities arising, okay, from the phase boundary. So this is a source of secondary plume is what Louise is saying, except we get it from the 660, okay? And again, you need really high resolution. Only recently has this been duplicated by my Japanese brother, Masaki Ogawa, okay? None of the American calculations have shown the secondary instabilities. And here we look at the influence of what happens when we change the sine of Clapeyron slope. Again, it's motivated by the work of Dan Chim. Okay, we put a negative Clapeyron slope about minus five megapascal versus a positive Clapeyron slope. Oh, this one's actually quite big. This one is minus 12 megapascal, and this is plus 12. Okay, and you can see the dramatic difference brought on by the influence of the sine of Clapeyron slope on the development of plume-like upwelling. Okay, so here we only focus on the effect of depth dependence. Okay, and you can see that when we put in a very strong positive Clapeyron slope, the boundary layer becomes much more stable, become much more unstable, and you develop these upwellings, okay. So this shows that when you have a phase transition in the deep part of the mantle, so close to the boundary layer, the sine of Clapeyron slope does matter. Okay.
So this is Clapeyron slope
for post-perovskite? Post-perovskite, yeah. So this is what Dan Chim, that's motivated by Dan Chim's work, where you put negative Clapeyron slope, and this is positive Clapeyron slope.
Yeah, I never thought that that said that.
Yeah, in my theater, it's extended. I mean, not constrained at all.
Yeah, but didn't you insinuate that you had negative? I mean, you did insinuate. You didn't say it, but you did insinuate.
So this is going to be published in the Journal of Insinuated Science.
But it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, but it shows the importance of... No, the 607 we know is negative, okay.
Right.
Oh, this is a picture of the whole mantle. This is 3,000 kilometers, and we have the post-perovskite down here, and then we have the spinel perovskite up here. Yeah. Yeah. So we have double negative in the case of Dan Shim, okay?
But qualitatively, of course, this is like what Uli Christensen and Hansen got from Mars, where they were putting the negative platform slope because of the phase transition to perovskite, which Mars is at the bottom of the Mars band. And they wanted to therefore say that that's what stabilized does. So in that sense, your results are consistent with what they
Right. have. Except here it's double negative, and in the case for Uli Christensen, was a single negative.
This is entirely heated from below.
Yeah, entirely heated from below, but what happens when you put internal heating is that the bottom boundary layer becomes even more violent. Yeah. You have a strong interaction, and it also raises the temperature. Now we look at something that the seismologists would be interested in, is the amount of reduction of the lateral heterogeneities when we put in the radiative heat transfer. So this top one is so here we're looking at the lateral thermal anomalies, and the top one here, and we look at for both positive Clapeyron slope, so this one would correspond to about 6 megapascal per degree, both are positive, and this is for constant conductivity, and this is for radiative heat transfer where we vary this parameter. So again, you could fine-tune this parameter, and here this constant is 10, but you could vary the function of depth if you have grain size effect as been proposed by Ann Hoffmeister. Okay, so this could be a function of depth also. And so you can see that what happens when we introduce radiative heat transfer, as been proposed by Badro and what we've looked at 10 years ago, is that the amount of lateral thermal anomalies are greatly reduced. Okay? And that's because the heat it's diffused away much more readily because of the feedback you have from radiative heat transfer.
What are we actually looking at?
What are you looking at? A rising thermal anomaly.
Point to the right thing that's rising.
Yeah. Yeah, the rising. Yeah, this corresponds. Yeah, this corresponds to something that looks like this, okay? So we just took the lateral thermal anomalies. We just took delta T is equals to T minus a horizontal T average. In fact, it's what you get from seismology is when you look at the lateral perturbation from a basic state. Okay, let's go on further, and look at the influence of temperature-dependent viscosity, and we're going to see that we have two orders of magnitude of temperature-dependent viscosity in the lower mantle. I'd like to call your attention to this the formation of these structures. Okay, you could get a really broad structure, but only with the radiative heat transfer. On the other hand, if you don't have radiative heat transfer, you get very dispersed patterns, okay? And they're not as long-lasting, or you have a lot of time dependence where these things move very slowly. So I think that this is a radiative heat transfer, and this is the constant conductivity, and they both have the post-perovskite phase transition, right? Now what happens when you increase the amount of temperature dependence is that the four orders of magnitude, okay, we look at extreme cases that you have the mantle becomes much hotter, okay, and these downgoings, these downwellings, they have a difficult time making it down to the lower mantle because they get absorbed by the radiative heat transfer. This shows the importance of including radiative heat transfer in the presence of post-perovskite is that it accentuates this asymmetry between the upwellings, okay, and the downwellings, and that the upwellings becomes much broader and they would go up through the lower mantle, and the downwellings which emanate from the top, they have a tough time making it to the bottom, because the thermal anomalies would be conducted away. And I'd like to point out a few other work that's been done by S. Nakagawa. Okay. And he shows also that when you increase the temperature, that the temperature in the interior of a post-perovskite well is a little bit higher by several hundred degrees. So you put an internal heating in there, like the amount that Louise was, you're going to melt the lower mantle. Okay, so this post-perovskite transition puts a tighter constraint on the amount of radioactivity in the lower mantle. And again, Nakagawa and Tackley, they look at this problem, but they didn't put in any radiative heat transfer, and you could see that they could not get things to be focused. And one of the questions raised by Tackley was how do I get to these long scale, these long wavelength features as advocated by Adam for the last 20 years, okay? And that was done before the work of Badro. And now we all could say that radiative heat transfer is one way of reconciling both the long wavelength features from the upwelling and the instabilities which are generated if you have a positive Clefron slope. So if Dan is right about negative Clefron slope, then we could throw away radiative heat transfer. But if Dan is wrong, then we'll need radiative heat transfer. And I thank you for your attention.